Thank you so much, Rabbi Rabinovich. Just Rabbanim, people from the shul family. It's an honor to be part of the Wexner Kol Elyon second annual conference. There's a variety of different topics showing how Torah, halacha, Torah values interface with all different facets of society, whether it be science, whether it be medicine, whether it be archaeology, or whether it be finance. Torah has what to say on everything. I think I mentioned last year that at the end of Pirkei Avos, Ben Bagbag says, that you have to toil and turn Torah around and around because everything is there. And the idea of hafochva vafochva, the way I like to understand it, is that if you have a kaleidoscope, when you were younger, you had these kaleidoscopes that were filled with different fractals or crystals, and you would hold it up to the light and it would show this beautiful mosaic. And if you turn it, every degree that you turn, the picture changes. And that's what Torah is. Torah has a finite number of words, halachos, and laws, and yet it's infinite because every single degree that you turn it, every single different angle yields an entirely different picture that you can apply to any single situation that you face in life or that the community faces in life. And so obviously in the times of Chazal, in the times of Tanakh, they did not have cryptocurrency. But as we'll see, halakha has what to say on it. And it's still an emerging technology, so the technology may change. And also, the halakhic discourse is continuously evolving. So what I'm going to present is, I guess, a summary of what some poskim say, as well as some of my own thoughts as well. And I welcome any feedback. The other caveat or disclaimer that I have is that I'm not a programmer. I don't know much about Bitcoin or blockchain technology. I'm pretty much in the dark, just as most of you are, unless you have a background in finance or blockchain technology. I'm going to do my best to explain what I understand. But if there's some deficiency, please chalk it up to me and not the Das HaPoskim. So, as I said, the topic is cryptocurrency and halacha, but we do have to start with something a little bit broader. And that is just money in general. What is money? So you have this quote over here from Adam Smith, the father of modern economists, who say that money, all money, is a matter of belief. What do you think that means? Why is money a matter of belief?
I guess it's worth whatever, you know, the consensus of the populations deem it's worth. Like gold is only worth what it is in gold because people think it's worth that much.
Yeah. So you could say that the belief is the belief in this currency itself, that this piece of paper or this coin or even this block of gold only has value because we attribute value to it. The famous mashal that the Chafetz Chaim gives, where a guy goes on a long journey to a faraway country to mine diamonds to bring home. And when he gets there, the streets are filled, are paved with diamonds, and nobody accepts them as currency. Instead, what do they use? They use chicken schmaltz. They use chicken fat. And over the year that he's there, he just completely loses focus and amasses large quantities of chicken fat, and by the time he comes home, it's all spoiled. Back there, the Chafetz Chaim uses it as a mashal to Olam Hazeh versus Olam Haba, but things have different value in different places. And there might not be anything intrinsically valuable to it. So that's one thing that we can believe in. What's another thing that we have belief in when it comes to money? So another thing that we'll see is the people who make the currency. We don't only have belief in the currency itself, but we also have belief in those who make the currency. For most of human history, it's been the government. With cryptocurrency, we believe in someone else as well. So just a little bit of history about how money evolved. Probably started out with bartering. I have something that I don't really need. You have something that I would like much more, and vice versa. And so we want to trade. That's probably how the earliest transaction started. There was no money. People didn't use gold or silver or copper. They had a cow. And they wanted to trade that for something else. So, you know, the famous tradition song from Fiddler on the Roof. You have different things that you're arguing about. You're going back and forth. The first trade that ever happened, according to Chazal, was by Kayin and Hevel. That didn't work out too well. But the Medrash says that Kayin and Hevel said, let's make a deal. I'll take all of the land, and you take all of the metaltalin, or all the movable objects. And so one said to the other, we'll take off your clothing. All those movable objects are mine. And the other one said, fly in the air. All the land is mine. Obviously, it's not meant to be literal, but it's showing how arguments start, but it's also showing how transactions start. And the problem with bartering, it's hard. You can't just say, I own everything and I'm going to trade you everything for everything. That doesn't work that way. Rather, an easier way and a more convenient way was with gold or silver or metals in general. So instead of, these aren't coins, that's a different stage, but just metal. What's good or what's useful about metal compared to a cow? Yeah, so it lasts longer, it's much more durable, it doesn't spoil. What's another reason why it might be more beneficial?
It's more portable.
Yeah, it's more portable, it's easier to transport. You can take it in a bag. What's a third reason? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You can divide it into little pieces. It's divisible. You can't, without transgressing Eivor Min HaChai, it's pretty difficult to break up a cow into pieces without it dying. There's one other reason why it's valuable. Yeah.
Standardized.
Yeah. So it's not as standardized as a coin, but it's much more standardized in that somebody would be willing to take it even if they don't want a cow. So they could use that gold for something else. So that's a later stage. It's interesting, according to Chazal, whether that when that happened or not. It probably happened. The question is when. So the reason why I have this picture of Damaris HaMachpelah here is from the Psukim in Chaye Sarah, where Avram is buying Damaris HaMachpelah. So it says that Avraham weighed out silver coins over Lasocher. But it doesn't say coins. It just says Shkalim. Shkalim means Mishkal, means weight. So some people say it just means he weighed out big blocks of silver that were used as money, even though it wasn't a standardized coin. Rashi and Chazal disagree and say that no, that this was one of the earliest instances of using coin. When Avraham got stuff from Paro, it was just gold and silver. It wasn't coins. It was just blocks. This was one of the first recorded instances of using actual currency. And in fact, Chazal say that Avraham minted his own coin. When Hashem says, Va'agadla Shemecha, I will make your name great, the Medrash says it means that he would mint a coin that would go into wide circulation. Yaakov Avinu, also, when he came back to Eretz Yisrael, Chazal say that one of the improvements that he made to the city of Shechem was by introducing coinage. So the Avos, the people that introduced monotheism into the world, Chazal also saw as introducing this currency. Now, what's unique about currency? What distinguishes coins from gold? What distinguishes a gold coin from gold? It's minted, meaning it's even more standardized. And this is where the whole trust thing comes in. Because the only difference between a block of gold and a coin is that a coin has a seal on it. You know, now we have gold bullion with seals, but back then it was just a block of gold. Here, this was a standardized size coin, and the king stamped it, or the king had a picture of himself on it. And what that meant is that the kings vouched for its weight in gold, and therefore, it would be worth X amount of money. So that's the next stage. And that pretty much went on for many, many years. So I have this picture from Masada. That's another instance where we found coins. The Yerushalmi says, though, that these coins that we found there are very unique because these coins were from the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. And the Yerushalmi and Meister Sheni, as well in Bava Kamma, according to some Mefarshim, say that those coins cannot be used for certain mitzvah obligations because they are not currency, because the government does not allow them. So we'll get back to that when we talk about the Chasam Sofer, but the idea of coins being an extension of the government and your trust and the power of the government, that really started when we began to mint coins. And it really went on for many, many centuries. The next stage is paper money, dollar bills. Then we have credit cards, peer-to-peer transactions like Venmo and Zelle. We're going to skip those. And then we have cryptocurrency, which is what I hope to talk about. So the halachic debate about modern money really starts with paper money. So how did paper money start? So paper money is actually pretty old, just not in the way that we know it. So this is from, I think, the 10th century in China. That's the first record of paper money that we have. The West, Europe, did not have paper money for many, many, many years later. I believe this is in the 1600s from England, and this is from the 1700s, 1779, in America. Now, what we normally associate bills with is that this is a piece of paper that's worth X amount of money. That's not what these are. These are what are called promissory notes. Promissory notes are essentially pieces of paper saying, I owe you money. What's that in Hebrew? We learned this year in Gittin. What's an IOU? It's a shtar. Yeah, it's a shtar of a halva saying that A owes B money. Now, you don't only have to hold on to this shtar. You can actually sell it to somebody else. Governments do that now. I think it's called distressed debt. That's kind of what happened in the financial crisis in 08, if I'm not mistaken. But it's been going on for thousands of years. The Gemara talks about it. How do you can sell debt to each other. So is this piece of paper actually worth anything? What do you think? You say, is this paper actually worth anything? Now, this is from America, and it said the bearer is entitled to receive 55 Spanish mil dollars or an equal sum in gold or silver according to Congress on the 14th of January, 1779, $55. So is that actually $55 or not? What would you say? You say no. Anybody disagree? So this is actually a big debate. It started off with private companies. So this is just a single person writing an IOU to somebody else in China. This was from a private company. Private companies were the first ones to make bills because they weren't actually bills. They were just promissory notes. And then governments, especially in times of war when there were liquidity issues, they started making them as well. So there was this progression of being adopted by governments. So here you have the Bank of Rahway, New Jersey in the 1800s that had a dollar bill. But again, it's not a dollar bill. This was a private bill because it wasn't actually currency. It was something you could bring into the bank and get money for and not have to carry around the dollar worth of silver. This is another one by Lake George, authorized by the state of New York, for $10 of silver. Then the government started making their own. So you have a $20 gold certificate by the government. Same thing over here, a silver certificate. So it says, this certifies that there is on deposit in the Treasury of the United States of America $1 of silver payable to the bearer on demand. Meaning you can go into a bank with this silver certificate. Again, it's not a dollar bill, but that's what they used, and get money for it. And you can see the advantages of this. You didn't have to walk around with large piles of gold and silver and coins, which made you a target. And it was also hard to schlep, especially if you're going out west or you're going through war-torn Europe. So this became really, really popular. And the shaila was, is this considered halachically money or not? And it's actually a machlokas. These are just two of the shitos. There are many more. There's an Oneg Yontif, there's a Shlomo Kluger. There's many, many opinions as to the status of them. But before we get to that, I have to ask you the question, which is, who cares? Meaning, I've just posed this question as to, is this money? Then what about, is Bitcoin money? Why do I care if it's money or not from a halachic reason, from a halachic standpoint? What would be nafka minas? What would be ramifications? Yeah. Yeah, so this gets into a bit of a broader topic. Let me see if I can get to that now. Yeah, sorry, here. So this is the city of Saloniki in Greece. That's, I think, Mount Olympus. In the 1500s, there was a great posek there, the Marashdam. So the Marashdam was the first one to deal with inflation when it comes to money. So just as an example, this is the price of coffee. A cup of coffee in the 1970s was 25 cents. In 2022, it's $1.85. It's probably a little bit more now. I don't drink coffee, so I don't know. But there's a Dunkin' Donuts right down the block. As you can see, same cup of coffee needs more coins. So you can look at that in one of two ways. Either coffee gets more expensive, meaning if you want a cup of coffee here, you needed one coin. Here, you need six coins. Or you could say that coins, the purchasing power, or the value of money got less. The value of money went down. Here, one coin will get you a whole cup of coffee, and over here, it'll only get you a sixth of a cup of coffee. So depending on what's your benchmark, either money goes down or coffee goes up. And so the Marashdam had this unique opinion that we look... That halacha does recognize inflation. Everybody else, though, disagrees. All other poskim say that halacha just looks at money being unchanging. The value of money, the value of a dollar, will always be a dollar. What changes is how much a cup of coffee is worth or the price of a cup of coffee. Halacha recognizes inflation by commodities, not by cash, not by money. The implications for that are many. One of them being what you mentioned, which is ribis. So we classically understand ribis of interest to mean that if I borrow $10, I can't pay you back $11. So that's ribis d'oraisa. That's biblical ribis. There are many gzeros or ribis d'rabbanans as well. One is what you mentioned of sa bisa, meaning that if I borrow a cup of sugar, if you live in an apartment and you need to go across the hall to get a cup of sugar, or earlier this year, I needed a Yahrzeit candle for Yontif, so I went across the hall and borrowed one. Halachically, I'm not supposed to give back to you a candle. Why? Because the candle, the value of candles might fluctuate. And it could be that when I'm paying you back, I'm actually paying you back a candle that's worth more than it was than I borrowed it, and that would be ribis d'rabbanan. So that applies by metaltalin, by objects. It does not apply to money, because money, we paskin, unlike the Marashdam who lived here, we disagree and say that money always remains fixed. So the most major nafkamina is, if you take out a loan in Bitcoin, how do you pay? Are you allowed to pay back in Bitcoin or not? If Bitcoin is not money, you cannot repay them in Bitcoin unless you make some halachic stipulations. If it's money, it doesn't matter. So that's one implication. What's another implication? Also connected to that. Next one is restitution, or tashlumen. So the Gemara in Bava Kama says, mishalem b'shas ha'gnever, b'shas ha'gzela. Also, if you damage somebody. So if I steal a cow, and then the price of the cow goes up in value, so do I have to pay you the current value or the original value? So the halacha is, you have to pay the original value. If it's money, though, we said money doesn't change. So barring dina de malchusa dina issues, halachically, if somebody hacks my crypto wallet and steals or manages to divert funds of crypto, it's very volatile. The price just goes up and down. So what do I have to pay you back? It depends. If it's money, I just have to pay you back whatever it is right now. If it's a commodity, I have to find out what it was worth at the time that I took it, and that's what I have to pay you back. Those are, I would say, the... those are...
How did you make the kinyan?
We'll get to the kinyan.
No, but you can't determine what the time of the kinyan is.
Yeah, so it depends on what kinyan... That's another ramification. So it depends on what the kinyan is. So just before we get to kinyan, another one of the nafkaminas are mitzvos, like pidyon haben or ma'aser sheni. Those are a little bit smaller. Maybe we'll touch on them a little bit later. The major one, though, is, again, a kinyan. How does it work? So we'll talk about it more in detail, but there are various kinyanim. There are various ways to acquire something in halacha. So if it's money, there are different ways that you can acquire money that sometimes don't work for acquiring metaltalin, for acquiring objects. and vice versa. But the bigger thing is that, well, what is Bitcoin and how do you acquire something that doesn't really exist? As we'll see, there isn't even a digital currency. What Bitcoin or blockchain technology is, it's literally just a long list of who sent money to who, but there's no actual money. So it literally doesn't exist. There's just a piece of paper saying this happened here, then this happened here, then this happened here. So the question is, can you have any Kenyan on anything that doesn't exist? So there is one POSEC who has a very unique position that says that any electronic transfer is not considered halachically final until you physically withdraw cash or do something with the funds. So that's what Rabbi Bleich, one of the Rashi Kolel and Dayanus Kolel, believes. A lot of ramifications for that. And it's not only Bitcoin. It's all electronic peer-to-peer or bank transactions. Many poskim, though, say no. That as long as whatever the standard procedure is, that's what works. That, in Gemara or halachic terms, is called Situmta. Whatever the standard procedure is, that's okay. So in this case, how does blockchain technology work? Again, we'll get to it later, but the simple thing is I push a button or I tap my phone and then it transfers and that's it. And then the computers will verify the transaction. So if we would take Situmta literally, what that basically means is that whenever I finish the transaction, poof, it's done. There is a machlokas, there is a debate as to whether that actually means anything. Can I do Situmta? Can I create that type of a kinyan without actually doing anything? The classic Situmta, like in the diamond business, is shaking a hand. Nobody's shaking hands here. I'm literally just tapping my phone and nothing's happening to anything else. So it's a machlokas aposkim if Situmta by a davar shein bo mamish, by not doing any maisa, by not doing any action, is halachically valid. I think the consensus of poskim is that it is. That's probably the best type of kinyan that you could do. Alternatively, you could do what's known as kinyan sudar, where just like when we sell chametz, you lift something up to symbolize your finality and certainty with creating that transaction. But again, that has limitations on what you can do that with. The final option is what's called validation, kinyan odisa. It's a little bit technical, and it's also very limited in its applications, according to many poskim. But generally, if people admit to something and there's proof of it, that may be considered a type of halacha kinyan. Again, that's very oversimplified, and I'm not really going into it so much because, again, there's a lot of debates as to whether it's actually valid in many cases or not. Kind of as a fallback, I would say you could rely on that. But the greatest or most certain way of creating or effectuating this type of transaction would be Situmta. Going back, though. So the Chasam Sofer was probably the earliest one that dealt with paper money. The Shaila was that there was a fund for orphans. Parents had passed away, and so the estate was left in the hands of an apotropos, a caretaker, and they were transferring the funds via banknotes, private banknotes, and there were transaction fees, and the price went up and down, and so they were trying to figure out how much to actually cash out with these banknotes. So somebody asked the Chasam Sofer, what's the status? And he said that if we would just take these letters at face value, he says, they are not money. He says, what is it? It's a shtar. It's a shtar raya. All it is saying that this person owes somebody else money, which the Gemara says is not called money. It's not gufo mamon. That's the halachic term. So if I have a paper that says the owner of this can demand a dollar's worth of silver, that's not a dollar's worth of silver. That's just a shtar saying that I get a dollar's worth of silver. However, the Chasam Sofer says, anything that is legal tender, anything that the government obligates you to accept as money, is considered to be halachic coinage. He says, avogeder matbeya, the halachic category of a coin, hu shegazar hamelech alav shetetzeh. He bases this off of many Gemaras, but any time that the king or leader legislates that this has to be used as money, that automatically attains the status of halachic money. And so in the olden days, if you refused to accept the king's coinage, that's tantamount to refusing to accept the king's authority, and you get the death penalty. Counterfeiting, for many, many centuries, was punishable by death. Tampering with currency was either punishable by imprisonment or death. And the Chasam Sofer actually has an interesting proof. He brings proof from what are known as diluted or clipped coins. So if you ever take a quarter, you'll see that there's a lot of ridges around it. And if you look at ancient coins, they also have, it's called milling. So the reason why they have that is to prevent people from what is known as clipping coins. When they didn't have milling in the olden days, people would take some tool and they would scrape off pieces of the gold and silver and melt it down. Either they could make a new coin or just easier to make a hunk of gold or silver. So that's bad. Why? Because you're essentially devaluing the currency. So that was punishable, again, by either imprisonment or death. But it happened. And another more innocuous version of that is when we walk around with coins in our pockets. They abrade. Especially in the olden days, if you go to a museum now, they're worn off. As durable as gold or silver is, they erode. And so there's less gold than there was at the beginning. There's less silver. And a third example, the Roman Empire did this a lot, and probably led to some of the economic collapse of the empire, was that they would dilute the coins, just like we did in the 70s and the 60s and the 50s. We diluted the metal ratio in the coins, and yet we said, oh, it's worth the same amount. That's basically forced inflation. And yet, despite the fact that there's less gold or silver, we still treat it as the same amount. So the Chasam Sofer says, why should that be? It's not worth that. It's not worth a dollar of gold because there's not a dollar's worth of gold in here anymore. So why do I still accept it as a dollar? It has nothing to do with its intrinsic value. It's because the king told me that it has to be worth a dollar. So the Chasam Sofer says that any time that a king legislates that this is legal tender, it automatically obtains the status of legal tender. And therefore, he says, by extension, just like you can dilute or clip a coin, you can just do that on an exponential level to a piece of paper. So this piece of paper is not worth anything, and yet the king says, you have to accept this. So, okay, whatever that value is, that's what it is. So the Chasam Sofer says that the metric for currency is legal tender. The Chazon Ish had a slightly different opinion. Chazon Ish has a very interesting philosophy about how the history of coins developed. It's in Yoredei Siminayim Beis. If you're interested in that, I urge you to read it. He says that it's not really about legal tender per se, it's about market adoption. He says, V'inyan ha-matbeya, kol davar she'eskimo alav b'nei ha-medina, limkor v'liknos bo, laharich bo es kol hashuk. The value of coins stems from when people in a community agree to use it, to buy and sell, and to use it as the benchmark to value all commodities on the market. Essentially, the Chazon Ish is basically saying, whenever I have a cup of coffee, and I say, hey, how much for this cup of coffee? And you think about, oh, what is this worth? It's worth a dollar. So you now have just said, this dollar is what everybody uses to buy and sell. And as you can see, this has a very big nafkamina for Bitcoin. We'll get to that in a second. So just a little bit more about how halachic money works. Chazal, the Chasam Sofer and the Chazon Ish are really coming from different Gemaras. The Chasam Sofer says that the idea of a king and a malchus being the metric for coins comes from Yerushalmi and also Gemara and Bava Kamma, where it says, Matbeya Shemorad, a coin of rebellion, kegon bar koziva, like bar kochba. This is the bar kochba coin. This says Shimon in Old Hebrew. This is a star because of koziva as a star. This is the Beis HaMikdash. This is a lulav, which was a military sign. That's why the Gemara and Sukkah says that we shake a lulav to show that we're like antagonizing the Satan. This says freedom to Yerushalayim. So it says, Eino Mechalel. You're not allowed to use it to transfer the Kedusha from Eiser Sheni. Why? Because it's not considered legal tender. Now, when was the Yerushalmi written? Before or after the Bar Kokhba Rebellion? After. Or most of it was written afterwards. Yerushalmi was finished around 200-300. Bar Kokhba rebellion was 130, I think, or something like that, 139. So presumably, the Yerushalmi is referring to afterwards, but that really kind of crystallizes the machlokas between the Chazon Ish and the Chasam Sofer. Even when the rebellion was going on, this was still not allowed by the Romans, right? The Romans were in charge. They didn't allow this. So is the reason why you're not allowed to use this because the government doesn't allow it, or because it's after the rebellion, so nobody uses it anymore, and it's more just like a historical novelty, and some people don't want to let the rebellion die? So the Chasam Sofer says that it really stems from the fact that the government has made it illegal. The Chazon Ish says, no, it has nothing to do with that. The only reason, and then again, the Chazon Ish is much more mistaber, makes much more sense when you read the Mefarshim, like the Pnei Moshe, the Pnei Yeshua, and the Meiri. All of them say that it has nothing to do, there's nothing magical about the government, it's just what allows you to use it. If people accept this as coinage, that's what the Torah allowed you to transfer the Kedusha of Maaser Sheni on, and if not, not. Look at the Rambam. The Rambam, in Hilchos Gzeila V'Aveda, he says that we have a concept of dina de malchusa dina, that you have to follow the laws of the government. But he says just because there's some upstart who decides to launch a dictatorship, it doesn't mean I have to listen to him. So the Rambam says, what is the metric for a halachically recognized king? He says it's if he makes coins. Avalim ein matveo yose, but if he doesn't have coins minted, hareyu kigazlan balzro, he's just like a thug. So the Chasam Sofer says that rulership and coinage are inherently linked. The Chazon Ish says, no, it's just a practical thing. But this is really where a lot of the machlokas stems from. The other part about halachic coinage, and again, this is also very important in countries that have adopted Bitcoin as legal tender, is what happens if you have multiple currencies, right? So in the olden days, we had gold coins, silver coins, copper coins. So are they all equal? So the Gemara in Bava Metzia says, no, they're not. It says, Hazav kona es hakesef, hakesef kona es hanachoshes, but not the other way around. So if I'm buying silver coins with gold coins, or if I'm buying silver, if I'm buying gold coins with silver coins or silver coins with gold coins, it depends on when the transaction actually occurs. So we have a klal that there's two types. We can break down transactions into two things. We have money and objects, or coins and payros. That's what the Gemara uses. So the way we paskin, the way we hold, is that money doesn't finalize the transaction. Acquiring the payros, acquiring the commodities, is what finalizes the transactions. So if I use a gold coin to buy an apple, when I give the gold coin, the transaction isn't finalized. Rather, it's only finalized when I get the apple. But what happens when you're buying currency or currency swaps? So what happens? So the Mishnah says it depends. If you're trying to swap gold and silver coins, you only finalize the transaction when you get the silver coin. If you're swapping silver and copper, it only happens, it's only finalized when you get the silver coin. So what's the difference? Why in one is gold the finalizing, and why in one is the silver the finalizing part? Yeah?
There's a question from before. You mentioned that when a government like accepts like Bitcoin as like a currency, what does that mean, like, if a government accepts, like if private people choose to make that transaction and they accept it, why does it matter if the government needs to accept that?
So what the Chasam Sofer says, so the Chazon Ish says it really doesn't. The Chasam Sofer disagrees, and he says from this Yerushalmi, from the Rambam, it shows that coinage falls under the domain of political leadership. That is one of the definitions of coinage. That's how the Torah understood it.
So can a government like basically forbid transactions with Bitcoin? Is that
yeah, right? According to the Chasam Sofer, absolutely. But anyway, so what's the difference, though, between gold, silver, and copper? So the Gemara explains that it depends on how liquid it is, how easy it is to use it. Silver is a lot easier to use than gold. Not too many people want to take gold coins. And so therefore, the gold becomes the fruit, becomes the commodity. When it comes to copper and silver, though, copper is the one that's most ubiquitous. Copper is the most liquid. So then the silver coin becomes the commodity. And so when you have multiple currencies, the Chazon Ish says, it really depends on whatever the standard is. And again, that's where he gets his whole idea of it's just whatever people use. It doesn't matter that the king says you could use this one, you could use this one, you could use that one. It doesn't matter. The Chazon Ish says it just depends on what is the most normally used, widespread type of currency. So that's where they both come from. Then history changed, which is modern money. That's what we have right now. This is not a silver certificate. This is a modern bill, Federal Reserve Note. Once we went off the gold standard and the silver standard, we have what's called fiat money. Fiat is Latin for let it be. The only reason why this is legal tender is because the government said it. This is worth absolutely nothing. The only reason why is our belief that the United States government will go to war to validate our transactions. They will do whatever it takes in their power to make sure that when I use this money, it will be accepted and they will enforce it. But there's absolutely no worth at all. The Chazon Ish and the Chasam Sofer were talking about in times when it was all backed by stuff. So nowadays, what would they say? The Chasam Sofer, who says that it depends on Dina Demachus Adina, what would he say about modern money? Yes, of course. Why? Because it's just Dina Demachus Adina. And the Chazon Ish? You think so. Why? Exactly, whatever people use. And so, even though there may have been some debates in the earlier generations, nowadays, both the Chasam Sofer and the Chazon Ish, everybody would agree that fiat money is legal tender. This has a lot of ramifications for Pidyon HaBen as well. So, meaning you can just use $5 bills for Pidyon HaBen, theoretically, or five bills for Pidyon HaBen, theoretically. So now...
Fiat money started, just out of curiosity?
I mean, it started at different times, at different times in different countries. I mean, the U.S. went off the gold standard in 30...
The 70s, wow.
Well, I mean, there's different stages. Like, we went off gold certificates during the financial crash, and then there was, like, the Bretton Woods stage post-World War II, and that's, we had, like, this hybrid gold system, and then there was the silver standard. Like, there's different stages. But the last time we went off was in the 70s, which was, like, 20 years after the Chazon Ish passed away. So now we get to Bitcoin. So what is Bitcoin? So, very, very simplified, okay? I want to send money to you, and I type in on my phone, I'm sending you one Bitcoin. So this transaction is represented as a block. This guy, Satoshi Nakamoto, we don't know who he is, it may actually not be one person, it might be a group of people. In 2008, they created this technology. It's an encryption code where everybody has their own password, and that unlocks a wallet or an account, and you have Bitcoin stored in it. Now, again, there's no actual Bitcoin. There's nothing there. It just says you have 1, 2, 3. It's a number. And I say, I want to give it to somebody else. So what happens then is that this transaction is a block of data. It's just a bunch of numbers saying A transfers to B 1 Bitcoin. That is then broadcast to all the other computers in the network around the world, millions and millions of computers. It's called decentralized finance. This block of data has a code. It's called a hash. Now, what's unique about it is that inside this box of data, it has a code, and it also has the code of the previous stage of transaction. And so when it's combined, it creates a chain of codes. So let's say, for example, this is the first block, so it only has one hash, it says A. And then this one has A, B. This one has B, C. So it creates a chain. And the reason why that's significant is that if you want to try to hack it, you then have to change all of them because they're all linked together because of all the overlapping codes, which makes it very, very difficult to hack. That's why Bitcoin is so effective. So the reason why he made it this way is because he wanted to create a type of modern money that wouldn't be tied to any government. He has a set number of coins, and it requires what's called proof of work. That's what Bitcoin miners do. They run algorithms to make sure that all of the transactions are valid. And once you have millions of transactions that are valid, once you have millions of computers validating it, it then gets added to a long chain, and everybody can see where the money went. But as I said, there's actually no money. It's just a list. It's just a digital piece of paper saying what goes where. Now, as you can see, Bitcoin started in 2010. This is 2022. The price has gone all up and down, very, very volatile. So a lot of people say, well, this is not money. This is just gambling, or it's nothing. And other people say that, no, this is the future. And just like with any technical or financial innovation, it takes time for it to stick. But we said that all money is belief. Here, the belief is not in the government. The belief is not in gold or silver. It's in the technology. It's in the usage of technology and our belief that it will ultimately be adopted. So it has no inherent worth. But in that sense, then the question is, how is it different from fiat money? How is it different from modern money? The only difference is it's not backed by government. So now in the United States... Right, and there's nothing tangible. That's correct, right? That is another factor when it comes to kinyanim. So in the United States, Bitcoin is not illegal, but it's not legal tender, meaning I can use it if I want, but nobody's forced to take it. So Elon Musk tried to toy around with it to accept it, and then it shot up, and then he said no, and then the price went down. I think some Burger Kings accept it. I think Microsoft accepts it. Wikipedia accepts it for donations. And I think AT&T is working on using it. But it's limited. It's very limited. And so according to the Chassam Sofer, would this pass the test? Would the Chassam Sofer say that it's money? No. Chassam Sofer would say it's not legal tender, so therefore it's not money. So what about the Chazon Ish? Would the Chazon Ish say that Bitcoin is money in America? So what did the Chazon Ish say before? What's the metric?
Market.
There's two things in the market. What did he say about the market? Whether people use it or not. And there was another factor, which is whether it's used as a benchmark for other commodities in the market or not. Meaning, when I have a cup of coffee, do I say this is one Bitcoin? So that's where we get interested. That's where it gets a little bit interesting. So there's two factors that we need to consider. There's the ubiquitousness of it. How accepted is Bitcoin in America? And the answer is not that accepted. There are people that vouch for it, but people don't use it in transactions. It's more as an investment tool right now. But let's say it does pick up in Zimbabwe right now. The currency is so overinflated, they just printed their first $100 trillion bill, and so now they're just using paper and cheese as money, just simple paper and cheese to make change. So if they started using Bitcoin there, I'm not comparing the Bitcoin to anything because there is no money. I'm just using Bitcoin. So the Chazon Ish would say that, yes, that would be sufficient to make it halachic money. But in America, let's say like in El Salvador in 2020, I believe, became the first country to authorize Bitcoin as legal tender. You have to accept Bitcoin if you pay for it. What if America did that too? What if America said, you have to accept Bitcoin? So the Chassam Sofer would say, sure. But the Chazon Ish agree. So it certainly would become ubiquitous. It would certainly become commonplace to use. But would it be the benchmark that people really use to measure things? Going back to the times of the Gemara when they had gold coins and silver coins, the Mishnah of the Gemara that said, Hazav, Kones, Akesef, there, people weren't thinking in terms of, okay, gold is worth this much and then I'm going to back calculate it into silver. No, they're just saying, you know, here, this gold is worth X amount of silver and that's it. They were both equal in terms of commodity. They were both equal in terms of coins, just some were more useful than others. Over here, Bitcoin has no value other than what you benchmark it off of. Meaning, the value of a Bitcoin is tied to the dollar. That a Bitcoin is worth $100, it's worth $200. I always translate it in my mind in terms of dollars. And so even if the government in the U.S. would authorize it as legal tender, it would always be, okay, this cup of coffee, I'll take Bitcoin, but then I'll say, how much is it actually worth in dollars? And then I'll charge you that amount in Bitcoin. So the dominant currency will theoretically always be dollars. So it could be that the Chazon Ish would say, even if it becomes legal tender, it might not actually ever become money until it supplants the dollar, or at least becomes equal to the dollar in terms of being able to calculate things on the market, which is very unlikely. So what I would say then is that it really depends. So here you have a Bitcoin ATM. If it becomes that ubiquitous, if it becomes legal tender, the Chasam Sofer would say yes. The Chazon Ish, it really depends on how the other currencies in the world are being used. The other factor is, well, what happens if it becomes ubiquitous in a small area? So I think there was a county in Massachusetts that said that all gas stations in the county have to be able to accept Bitcoin at the gas stations. So that's an industry-specific area, and it's a geographic-specific area. But maybe, again, according to the Chasam Sofer, that wouldn't work. But maybe according to the Chazon Ish, if everybody just thinks in those terms, maybe that could be good. Really depends. So, time's up, and so I want to just close. We've been talking about how money really stems from your belief in the government, your belief in what it's worth. There's actually something else to it. On all American coins, we say, in God we trust. And we're actually putting our belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the money. And that's not just something that the Founding Fathers thought of. The Gemara in Pesachim says, Shloshet dvarim olu b'machshava libaros, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had in his mind to create three things. He had his mind to create a lot of other things also. But there were three things that he wanted to create. V'im lo olu, and even if he didn't actually think about it, dinu sheyalu, it means that he really should have. So what are they? Al hames sheyasriach, that the dead should decompose. V'al hames sheyishtakach min halev, and that the pain of loss should become dulled over years, essentially enabling humanity to move on. V'al hatvua sheteirakev, and that produce should ultimately rot. That, again, it's saying we don't want people to hoard, we need progress to happen. And without that, if things would just last forever, we wouldn't be able to move on. Those are things that the Gemara Pesachim says, but then it says something else. V'yesh omrim al hamatveya sheyetze. That in addition to all of those psychological factors of being able to cope with grief and loss and with amassing fortunes, there was something else that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should have thought of, and that is the ability for a coin to be accepted. And the Marsha asks, well, this has nothing to do with anything else here. This is a human invention. But the answer is, and the Chasam Sofer in his Tshuva says that no, there's something almost divine or embedded in creation that allows the concept of coinage to work, that allows modern finance systems to work. I have over here a shekel with fire. So, in Parshas Kisisa by Parshas Shkalim, so Hashem shows Moshe Ze Yitnu, a fiery coin the size of what a Machzis HaShekel was supposed to be. And what's very interesting is that the coin is supposed to be silver, but fire has no weight. And so it's really just the size. Hashem is saying that there is sanctity to just simple metals. You can take something, you can take a block of gold and a block of silver and use it for Machzis HaShekel, for Karbonos. You can use it for Pidyon HaBen, for Maaser Sheni. And you can even use it, just like Avram and Yaakov did, to move society forward, to build a Ma'aras HaMachpelah, to buy a Ma'aras HaMachpelah, to build up the city of Shechem. You can do all of that. All you need is this Matbeah Shel Eish, the size of it. How you circumscribe all of those resources, that has to be something spiritual. That has to be something from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, using the Ratzon HaTorah to shape all of those resources. And that phenomenon of being able to essentially work as a civilization, to attribute value to something purely based on what it represents, our faith in Malchus, our faith in something that it represents HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or our faith in ourselves to be able to create a system, that is the matbeah shel esh, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, if you have all of those systems, al pi chukei HaTorah, you will be able to build an incredible society. And so, to sum up, the halachic implications of Bitcoin. I think it's safe to say that right now it's not considered money. It is considered a commodity. According to the Chassam Sofer, with the exception of El Salvador and the Central African Republic, there are no other countries where it is legal tender. You could use it, but you don't have to use it. And according to the Chassam Sofer, that is the metric. And until anything changes, it will always be a commodity with ramifications for ribis, for gneva, for gzela, for tashlumin, all of those things, for kinyanim, all of those things, it would be classified as a commodity or as a peri. If it becomes more ubiquitous, then we get into a machlokas. Maybe the Chazon Ish would argue and say, even though it's not legal tender, if everybody is using it, and if it becomes the benchmark for an economy, then maybe that would be different. And if it becomes legal tender, the Chassam Sofer would say that it would be money. Until that point, though, I think it's safe to say that it's primarily used as an investment tool. In America, that's how it's taxed. In Israel, that's how it's taxed. And so for the time being, it is a commodity, but you never know, things may change. Once again, thank you so much, and if you have any questions, happy to take them.